Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. April 11th, 2024, the Arizona Territories 1864 Abortion Law Edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast. I'm in Vermont. I'm still recovering from my encounter with the sublime, with the total eclipse on Monday, which outperformed all expectations. It was extraordinary. It was just really great. I'm so glad we talked about it, and then I'm so glad to have experienced it. From CBS Primetime, always sublime, is John Dickerson in New York. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven and New York Times Magazine and the Yale University Law School, also sublime, and in fact, a member of the band Sublime, is Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
I definitely want to be in that band with you guys.
Lots of my younger colleagues are really big Sublime fans, but I don't really remember what Sublime is. I know they're a band. You guys are blank spaces.
Your ad here, blankness on my face. Hey, would you tell us a little bit about the eclipse since you just talked about it? I mean, like, now that you went through it, what was it like?
Well, shadows, darkness fell, swept across. We have a house on a hill, and so you could see the eclipse coming across the hill. You could see the darkness coming. Also, what's amazing is that until totality, it's really quite bright outside. It gets somewhat darker, somewhat chillier over the sort of half an hour before, but it's still very bright. And then suddenly, there's this dark shadow that comes, and the sun is a black hole in the sky with a ring of fire around it. And you gaze in wonder. And you can take your eclipse glasses off at that point and stare directly at the sun, which, of course, is itself magnificent. And then there's these several minutes of where you're just gazing in wonder. And then a flash of light as this diamond ring effect, this little bit of light at the edge of the sun comes out and everything changes back to the world. It's wonderful. Anyway, it was great. It was, and we got good weather in Vermont, much to everyone's surprise.
That's so great. Did you see that the search terms along the path of totality were things like eye pain and how do you get rid of eye pain? People basically didn't listen and stared up into the sun. I mean, it's so sad. We didn't have the glasses, so we used a colander. But we weren't in the path of totality. So it was basically just like, you know, like a storm blew in with no rain.
This week on the Gabfest, Arizona revives a draconian 1864 abortion law, which in turn undermines Trump's announcement that he wants to leave abortion to the states. Then why did No Labels abandon its effort to run a third party presidential candidate in 2024? And then, should Biden debate Trump? Should Trump debate Biden? Should anyone debate anyone? Plus, of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. So for the second week in a row, abortion states, the presidential election, are top of mind. Trump announced this week in his own hyperbolic but not quite clear way that his new policy was that abortion should be left to the states. And he also supports exemptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. This was Trump's attempt to avoid endorsing a national abortion ban. He doesn't want the political weight of having to carry a national abortion ban in the general election. But then the Arizona Supreme Court deeply messed with his plans. At the behest of Republicans, the state Supreme Court revived an 1864 territorial law banning and criminalizing abortion in essentially all circumstances, which felt like an incredible gift to Democrats in that swing state, which has a Senate election and a close presidential election. And fortunately, we have the world authority on 1864 abortion laws on the Gabfest, Ms. Emily
Bazelon. Jedediah Frumpenchair, who has been revived from 1864.
Yeah, the closest thing to Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes is Emily Bazelon. Emily, like, take us back. What is this 1864 law? Why has it come back to life zombified?
Yeah, so I am working on a book about reproductive rights, and this is part of my research. The 1860s is when the idea of criminalizing abortion before quickening, which is when women feel fetal movement, which can be quite late, like between 15 and 18 weeks or even later, comes about. So you have centuries in which, like under British common law and American law, early in pregnancy, until women say they can detect a pregnancy, abortion is allowed and permitted and not even all that rare, honestly. And then in the 1860s, male doctors who are trying to take over obstetrics, they're like the first obstetricians, and they're trying to push women out of being non-medical school trained doctors and also midwives. They're like taking over the field, and they get behind the idea that they're the ones who get to say when life begins, and life does not begin at quickening. It begins at conception. And the really first big crusade of the American Medical Association is to criminalize abortion. And it's somewhat successful. A bunch of states pass laws like Arizona's, and they are this very uncompromising kind of law in which there are very few or almost no exceptions.
So, Emily, was this massive act of mansplaining, was that because abortions were performed by women?
No, I mean, some were. There were a couple of really visible abortion providers who were advertising their services in cities like New York City and Boston, and there were men and women. It was mostly, John, that they were what were called irregulars. They hadn't gone to medical school. Now, the thing about at the time, part of this whole tussle for power is that going to medical school does not make you good at practicing medicine.
In 1870, certainly not, yeah.
Right. And there's this whole other big problem that especially affects women in labor and delivery, which is that actually there are antiseptics, but people aren't using them. And so doctors had the idea that they didn't have to wash their hands because they were gentlemen. And they were the ones who would go from, you know, taking care of a patient with some deadly infection to labor and delivery. Midwives and women who attended at birth were much less likely to do that. So actually the death rates, I mean, there are these crazy quotes about how, like, if you called in a male doctor, that was because, like, the Grim Reaper was at the door. And so they really needed something else to sell. And they sold this kind of idea, like, we have the superior scientific knowledge, and banning abortion gets caught up in that.
And so Arizona ends up passing a law like this in the 1860s, even though it's not yet a state. So it's a territorial law. And what happens to that law over time?
Well, it was in effect and not probably rigorously enforced. A lot of these laws tend to languish because prosecutors and even the police don't have a big appetite for going after abortion provision. But there was some enforcement. And then with Roe versus Wade in 1973, it becomes zombified, right? The Supreme Court creates a constitutional national right to abortion, and all these books, all these laws become dead letters. But Arizona never repealed the law, so it was sitting there. And that's what the Arizona Supreme Court said. They said, okay, well, now we have Dobbs. It's replaced Roe. States can make their own decisions. This is good law.
And why does it overcome a 15-week ban that exists in Arizona, which the subsequent abortion legislation, more recent legislation?
Well, what the court said was that when the legislature passed the 15-week ban, they did not repeal the other ban. So basically, from the court's point of view, and this is a conservative Republican court, those laws just like coexist, even though, of course, like once you have a total ban, you don't really have a 15-week ban anymore.
Can I sneak in here and use that as an opportunity to talk about a human life amendment to the Constitution, which is the position in the Republican Party platform? It's also the position in the Republican Party platform for a national 20-week ban. But along those same lines, Emily, a human life amendment, as I understand it, is if you declare human lives to start at conception, then that's a total abortion ban, isn't it? And therefore, haven't they gotten in Arizona what is a plank in the Republican platform?
Yeah, pretty much. And there are a whole bunch of states that have these same kind of bans. And I mean, a human life amendment would go further, right? Because it would actually give the fetus the rights of a human being. And that's what we saw with the Alabama decision. That's why IVF was risked by what the Alabama court did. Because once you start talking about lawsuits and fetuses being, you know, murdered as if they had human rights, then there isn't, logically speaking, a reason why you would allow for, you know, an embryo to be destroyed, et cetera, et cetera. It can go really far.
And the reason I raise this is because you now have Republicans in Arizona and some others, Donald Trump, as David mentioned, trying to distance themselves from this. And there is a bit of a parlor game where you like take something from a platform that's random and say, ah, this is what the party believes. But I mean, the Republican Party and abortion, it's not there. You know, they have cared about this in the past. And I guess the point is that I'm trying to make is they basically caught the fire truck in Arizona. I mean, this is along the way towards the goal of what the party has stood for, It's not just some random thing that happened in Arizona. It is party policy.
Absolutely. The Human Life Amendment has been part of the Republican Party platform since the early 1980s. Ronald Reagan embraced it. They never took it out. They have tried many times to pass it. And it does have all the implications that we're talking about. You're also right that, like, the dog caught the mail truck is what happens when states start to pass these kinds of bans. And that is the America that we now live in. The question is whether we want to have a national Human Life Amendment that would make that national policy.
I think the dog caught the mail truck is actually what's going to happen in a Trump presidency with a Comstock Act, where they're going to unleash the dogs on the mail trucks to prevent them from delivering mifepristone across state lines. Actually, Emily,
I mean, that's a great point.
No, that was very, that was very clever.
That was adept. And you're right. Wait, I have to say one thing about that, which is that the Heritage Foundation's you know, position papers for their priorities for 2024 includes enforcement of the Comstock Act, which is, of course, the 1873 law, same era, different dude, though. Anthony Comstock was like his own religious crusader guy. But anyway, that one makes it illegal to send through the mail. Originally, it was any obscene material. It was really about erotica and pornography, but it looped in birth control and abortion, any products that can be made to use those things. And the abortion part of it is still law.
Do you think there's going to be mandatory wearing of hoop skirts and corsets?
I think there might be. Yes. Comstockery. Let's bring it back in full. I want
trad wife fashion circa 2026. But actually, Emily, in all seriousness, with the Comstock Act, how would it be different on a federal level for, again, a sort of zombie federal law to be brought back to enforce mailing of mifepristone or misoprostol across state lines? Is there any reason to think that federally this is a different situation, or it's the same thing? It's like this is live law, and the Supreme Court can uphold it.
Okay, so Comstock, yes, remains on the books. I should start by saying that there is a doctrine, and I looked up how to pronounce it. It's called desuetude, for not enforcing very, very long dormant statutes. In other words, there's an idea that if a law is just like lurking there, zombified, like you said, David, you don't resuscitate it, because the people who enacted it are so far in your dim past that they shouldn't have that kind of power. And there's like a reason that they didn't enforce it. That said, Comstock is still on the books. And so the question is whether there will be an American president who will enforce it. That is what we have not had, lo, these many years, in part because of Roe, but not only because of Roe. The Comstock Act is sitting there in the same way that the Arizona 1864 statute is sitting there. And Justice Thomas brought it up at oral argument and basically said, you know, invited that. And I think we will see an opinion from him about the Comstock Act in the mifepristone case.
John, can we turn to the politics of this? So there are... We talked last week about Florida, and the point that you made so smartly was it didn't feel like Florida's 6-week abortion ban, which is its Supreme Court just upheld, it was going to necessarily affect the vote in Florida, but that what it might do is just increase the salience of abortion as an issue in the public eye. Do you feel the same way about this Arizona one, that this doesn't have an impact on Arizona per se, but that it has a national impact, or it has an Arizona impact plus a national impact?
I think it has both. I think you've seen the Arizona impact by the scrambling of Republicans in Arizona, including Carrie Lake, the Republican Senate hopeful in the state. And we should get, Emily, your take on this like sudden affection for federalism on the question of abortion. And also, obviously, so it plays a role in Arizona. It's also playing the Democratic governor in Arizona. You know, has a strong voice. There are forces, you already saw the Democrats try to pass in the legislature a reversal of this law. The Republicans turned it down. So I think it could be, in a way, ground zero, because Arizona is a battleground state. And it has two of the three challenges for the Biden campaign. The three challenges being immigration, inflation, and is old, Biden is. The immigration and inflation's everywhere. Immigration obviously is a challenge for a border state like Arizona. So as a Democrat, you want to talk about anything other than those two things. And this issue is not just about an 1864 law. It's about who has the fundamental right to control the female body? Is it the woman herself? Is it the Supreme Court? Is it the legislature in Arizona or a referendum? So that presumably will be what the debate is about, and which is why it's unsatisfying for the purposes of political cover, in addition to the fact that we should talk about whether you can take anything Donald Trump says about anything at face value, particularly on abortion, where he's been pro-choice and he said it's murder. Well, if you believe it's murder, then the 1864 law is pretty good for you, presumably, if you believed any of those things. But he has no obvious interest in believing anything that might hurt him. So in this case, he now is a big federalist. But that doesn't, I don't think, get at the idea that the essential argument of the Democrats is that the Republicans want to make your choices for you. This is the one that they think works with voters. And I think that's still alive, even if you were to try to create a position that puts you in favor of states' rights.
Yeah, I think that's a really good set of points. I mean, one thing about both Arizona and Florida and these ballot initiatives that are pro-abortion rights that are up in November is that the voters are facing the absolute most stark choice, right? So this is a near total ban and a 6-week ban. Arizona has the near total, Florida has 6 weeks. It's not hypothetical. It's not like hanging over our heads and a court might allow this to happen. It is actually going to happen. The clinics are going to close. And so that part of it is just going to make it really clear for voters the differences they're talking about. And yeah, they do get to choose, right? I mean, that part of Trump's Federalist argument is preserved. But the idea that, you know, Republicans are pro, you know, the big pro-life groups are absolutely celebrating what's happening in Arizona. And so again, the Republicans are trying to hold a lot of different positions here.
And the pro-life groups are, you know, issuing statements against Donald Trump, who said he wouldn't sign a national abortion ban. First of all, the man has centered his entire presidential campaign on an easily verifiable lie about the 2020 campaign. So I think we need to find some language to convey how provisional anything he says about any position is. But I haven't quite found that language yet. But in this case, they may have issued some, you know, denunciations of his position on a national abortion ban. But I don't think there should be any doubt in anybody's minds that should he be presented with something that's inconsistent with something he said in the campaign, that he wouldn't easily reverse his position if it was in his interest to do so. And there's this funny little fight he's in with Lindsey Graham, where Lindsey Graham is saying, oh, no, you know, your position on a national abortion ban is wrong. We must have one. I have no evidence of this. I am saying something that is completely out of my hat. But I don't think it's insane to imagine that that whole fight is fake. Because Trump believes that being in favor of allowing states to do what they want is a better political position. And so he gets into a fake fight with Lindsey Graham so that somebody who wasn't paying too much attention would say, you know, look, he's in a fight with one of his own people about this. He doesn't believe in a national ban.
Huh.
Yep.
If I were the Democrats in the Arizona state legislature, I would not be pushing too hard to try to get this law overturned fast, this ruling overturned fast.
Oh, well, they can't. There is no way to get it. The one thing that they're doing, the Attorney General of Arizona, who's a Democrat, is saying that she is not going to enforce it. She's not going to prosecute people, and that will just like put pressure on conservative county prosecutors to do so.
Well, I guess I wouldn't work too closely with Republican legislators to come up with something that supersedes to repeal the 1864 Act. Which they tried to do in the Republican,
and
they
were shut down. Saying,
you want that kind of on the books when people go to vote. If you are for political purposes, you don't want it for the health of women purposes, but for political purposes, you definitely want people to be facing that stark choice. I mean, you could literally not come up with a better test for Democrats or for this issue than Arizona. It's like an 1860 law, ridiculous 1860 law that no one knew existed, pushed through by a Supreme Court that is packed with conservative judges. You know, if you want to galvanize pro-choice voters in the world, this is how to do it. And you have abortion on the ballot.
I mean, I totally hear you on the politics. I do just have to say, like, the South is closing for people who are seeking abortion, right? So now you have Arizona and Florida. The distances for people who want in-person abortions are increasing. You know, whether they can get pills, that's going to be an increasingly, obviously, important avenue. But you're also, the clinics are going to have to close and then they're going to have to reopen. Like, that's not nothing in terms of the.
No, I'm not saying there obviously are consequences. It's just from a political perspective.
I know.
John, just finally on this, is this as much of a blow up for Trump as it seems? Exactly the wrong headline at the moment he makes this announcement?
I mean, yes, but you have to put it into whatever larger perspective we decide rules the vote once it starts happening in late October in of this year, which is to say, there was also other bad news for Biden this week with the inflation rate coming in at higher than expected. Immigration migration at the southern border is actually down from where it was, but that issue is not going away. So this is not good for Trump. It's not good for Trump in a swing state. It attaches to other issues beyond abortion, where he is bad, and it's bad for him with suburban women who he needs to bring back. So I don't want to downplay the political damage of this, but it doesn't happen in a vacuum. And those three problems that Biden has got, those are still there, and those are, you know, bouncing around every day.
Do you want to hear more from us after this episode? In fact, do you want to hear more from us for the rest of your life or for the rest of the life of the universe? Well, it's possible you could, because there are now AI that allow you to listen to the dead speak. That's not what you'd do today. Today, you'd just be hearing a Slate Plus segment, because every week we do a bonus segment on the GabFest for Slate Plus members. And these bonus segments are some of the most fun things we do. You can only get them if you're a member, which you can become if you go to slate.com/GabFestPlus, which gets you all sorts of other incredible bonuses, unlimited content on the Slate site, other bonus episodes. And our topic this week is about AI reviving the dead and whether it is possible, using all these wonderful tools, or I use wonderful in quotes there, wonderful tools of AI, the large language models and the ability to recreate voices and create faces, to engage with someone who is dead, who you have a record of in perpetuity, and have ongoing conversations and text chains with them. Or perhaps, did you guys contemplate this? An endless string of GabFests, if we just capture our voices, all the stupid things that we say week after week, and people could listen forever.
No, dude, we can do this now. Basically, because here's why. It's obviously, look, I have an entire podcast designed to be self referential and solipsistic. So I feel like I should speak to this. You could feed, because we have lots and lots of material from all of us, GabFests and the things we've written ourselves. And you could already do this now.
A million percent.
Say to it, have a debate about the Arizona law, and I bet it would be better.
Yeah. It's not clear that we are actually doing the show. That's my point. We'll talk about this on the Slate Plus segment. Yes. I'm not even sure if we're doing
it. We're all patched together.
Right.
I don't even know if I'm alive anymore.
We couldn't teach.
Oh my god.
No, your description of your description of the eclipse is proof you are.
I was gonna say that the moon zapped your brain when it crossed over the sun.
All right. Anyway, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus so you can listen to this excellent to come segment. Also, GabFest listeners, do you know that John has a new podcast? He just mentioned it, so you probably do. It's called Navel Gazing, and it's John's contemplating sort of some of the writing that he's done over the years for himself and going back and revisiting it. And the first episode dropped this weekend, and it is like all the best of John Dickerson. It is deep. It is humane. It is funny. And now it comes to you in a dose every week. And I was just hearing from our producer, Shana, that John is now apparently also the therapist to some hundreds of listeners who have been moved by his observation. So check out Navel Gazing, which is, I think it's in our feed, or is it in our feed, or is it in its own feed, John?
It's in our feed. It has its own feed. And now episode 2 drops on Saturday. And if you're a Slate Plus member, you can get episode 3 earlier.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
No Labels announced this week that it had failed to recruit a candidate to run a centrist third-party candidacy against loathsome Donald Trump and doddering Joe Biden. No Labels spent tens of millions of dollars on polling and message testing and probably like really delicious dinners for Chris Christie and Mitt Romney and flights to go visit Larry Hogan and Joe Manchin. And, you know, they probably donated some West Virginia organization that Joe Manchin likes to butter up Joe Manchin. But they folded their tents abjectly and said, you know, Hogan and Romney, Manchin and Christie and Kemp, they do not want to do this. Not a single out of favor white guy centrist wants this job. So, John, why did they fail?
Well, they failed because they had a cockamamie theory of the case, which I can say now because I think Ruth Marcus was on the show when they sort of launched or when we last talked about this. And, you know, I try not to make, you know, extravagant claims because I'm both, you know, never quite sure. Life is unpredictable. But I mean, I had to put ice packs on my eye from the eye rolling that I engaged in when I read their, you know, theory of the case, which was essentially that there's this huge group of free-floating independents out there and that they're starving for a candidate, and they showed this polling that they spent a lot of money for. A, it's not clear at all that there is a free-floating group of independents out there. There are a lot of people who call themselves independents, but when they vote, they end up sorting to the two parties, and their allegiances are not. Their allegiances to the parties are pretty sticky. But the larger thing, which is crazy and which we all know from human life, is that the imagined perfect candidate will always poll well against reality. My imagined novels are all New York Times bestsellers, but I haven't written them. And so it was playing on this idea, which I think is super, super pernicious. And there are other pernicious ideas behind this, but it's super pernicious to sort of say, there's this alternative out there and it's easily grabbable. It's on the shelf and all we need is some money and everybody just needs to be reasonable. And it'll happen. And that was cockamamie and it fell apart, for the reasons, you said, David. I think one of the other pernicious, just since I'm on this jag, the pernicious idea that Trump and Biden are, from the perspective of people who care about centrism and bipartisanship, which is the argument that No Labels was trying to make, if you come to the world with that viewpoint, an argument that makes the case that Biden and Trump are equivalent in any way is divorced from the human life we live. And it's pernicious because it suggests they are similar. If you're a centrist and you care about using government to address the issues of the day through a bipartisan mechanism, like Joe Biden is your president, both the issues line up with what No Label said they cared about and the way in which he approaches government. Donald Trump never really engaged in any way in the kind of deal making required to get things done. Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, all these senators he could have talked to, he barely talked to do anything. He doesn't believe in the process. And certainly his next term is one in which he will treat the inefficiencies of the American system created by the founders as things to be bypassed with whatever power moves he can make. So to create a whole system saying, oh, these two guys are essentially the same, is actually an incredibly damaging thing to the world we live in right now where the stakes are high.
Well said, John. I mean, it was a full employment program for pollsters and for old, out of favor, you know, middle of the road Democrats. But other than that, what was the point of this? There was great dope. I don't know if you guys read that about how another Biden supporting group, Third Way, worked to sabotage No Labels. That Third Way was like, these guys are dangerous, and we're gonna go and meet with everyone they're trying to meet with and explain to Joe Manchin, as if he needs it explained, why this is a terrible idea and you shouldn't do it. And clearly, I don't think that was dispositive. I think Joe Manchin on his own probably could have come up with the logic that this is a misbegotten fantasia. But it is interesting that this other Biden supporting group was like, we gotta snuff this out.
I also noticed that part of the story with interest. And, you know, the thing that is somewhat surprising to me is that they couldn't find a single faded warrior who is a big enough egomaniac to take this on, right? Like, where's the Vivek Ramaswamy of this cadre of people? And I guess the answer to that is, like, it's sort of RFK, although RFK is, like, being so bizarre and weird in the stances he's taking that it doesn't fit the New Labels formula. But that was the only part of the story that surprised me, was that no one, just for their own self-promotion purposes, decided to take this chance to run.
It's a good point, Emily. And also, I mean, the one, if you were a person of these kinds of ideas, these sort of moderate centrist ideas, which again, line up pretty closely with what, like, Biden, not only Biden believes, but if you look at the Pew polling about the topography of the parties and what they believe, there are far more Democrats who believe sort of in change within the system, as opposed to real radicals who want to, like, do away with capitalism or democracy, or, you know, completely rewire the institutions. They want to do, you know, they want liberal ends, but with the means that we have. And so the party itself is more consistent with the kind of moderate vibe that No Labels was trying to capture. But imagine if you were one of these billionaires kicking around and you just wanted to, like, a lark. Why not take this up for the purposes you said, Emily, which is sort of ego enhancement. And by the way, if you really cared about these issues, you could become an evangelist for them. And again, it might not work electorally, but yeah, it's a really good point that nobody thought it might be fun to just travel the country and kind of get on TV a lot and try to actually maybe even change the dialogue.
Yeah, but you might really embarrass yourself and I don't think Ralph Nader,
yeah,
after 2000, very different kind of campaign, but I don't think Ralph Nader's reputation ever really recovered from how he impacted that campaign.
Totally.
The bigger threat, yeah, to Biden, Emily, is obviously, like, from these candidates from the left or wherever RFK is, from Mars, from the middle of the Hudson River. So with Jill Stein, with Cornel West, and then with RFK, who threatened to attract progressives or people who are dissatisfied, but mostly, in the case of Jill Stein and Cornel West, are dissatisfied on the left. That seems to be the big threat. And actually, before I let you answer that, why do we not have a Cornel West equivalent on the right, or Jill Stein equivalent on the right? Why isn't there someone running to the right of Trump? Is it because there's no space to run to the right of Trump? Like, literally, he will go as far right as it's needed to keep anybody out. But I do think there could, you know, hypothetically, there's someone who could, you know, pull in some of the alt-right voters who, like, are dissatisfied with Trump's squishiness on something, on Jews.
Well, at that point, you're into David Duke territory.
Mm-hmm. Careful what you wish for.
Who endorsed Trump. I don't know if he's endorsed him this time around, but, I mean, he endorsed him in 2016 and at Charlottesville said that, you know, they were aligned with Trump's views. So the white nationalists have already... Also, to the right, Trump defines the scale. But I mean, so many voters have changed what they believe about with respect to conservatism to just fit whatever he says, that you would try to move to the right and then the goalposts would move, or whatever it is you measure ideological,
yeah,
spectrum on.
Yeah.
Can I go back to the Stein West RFK question? Is it plausible that, yes, Stein and West, you know, creep into Biden support to some small but perhaps meaningful degree on the left, but that RFK takes some Trump voters and they cancel each other out? Or takes more Trump voters?
Yeah. You'd have to look in, basically, we're looking really in Nevada.
He's only on the ballot in
North Carolina, Nevada, right? Or the swing-ish states, New Hampshire, right?
Right. Nevada, New Hampshire. I'll add a caveat. I'm not sure New Hampshire would matter, but Nevada and North Carolina could. I'm still skeptical about North Carolina being a battleground state. But anyway, so let's say Nevada. I guess it could be possible. I'm trying to catch up recently with the sort of chaos voter. We've talked about this on the show before. The voters who are basically like, I just want the system to be in total chaos. Tom Etzel's written about this. And so to the extent that RFK Jr. is the chaos candidate, that might be where he takes some Trump voters.
Can we just spend a little last second here on Joe Lieberman, who died last week? He became as close as any person ever to becoming vice president of the United States. And, you know, had a long career as a senator, was a Democrat, became an independent, was the head of No Labels in his final years, died after a fall in his 80s. He's an interesting and annoying character in recent American political history. A lot to admire and a lot to be just annoyed by. Where does the balance end? Like, was he a force for good? He was a person who worked across the aisle. He was a person who he and John McCain had a famous friendship. He was, you know, vehement about wanting Bill Clinton to resign during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which I think history has kind of partially vindicated him, mostly vindicated him, perhaps. Yet also sanctimonious, annoying, also represented Jewish life and faith in a new way in American public life, which was interesting for Jews and mostly, I think, for the good. Emily, he was your senator.
I found him very irritating as my senator, frankly, because it just seemed like he was constantly undermining liberals and doing it, as you said, in the most sort of sanctimonious, pompous way. I'm sure I should find in my heart some nice things to say about this man who just died. But as a senator, he just kind of drove me crazy.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
So the networks, including perhaps John Dickerson himself, because he's a great writer, are drafting a letter imploring the two major candidates, Biden and Trump, maybe RFK Jr. soon, to submit to presidential debates this fall, as they have for the past almost 50 years. John, why are you writing this letter? If you're writing it, why is it necessary? Are you writing the letter? You don't need to answer that. John is not writing the letter.
I'm not writing the letter. I have complicated feelings about presidential debates in general, because I don't think they're useful as a way of understanding whether one of the two men has the attributes for the job. Because I think attributes are really important, and positions can be read in position papers. And so I think debates are a way to excavate their attributes and also what their core approaches are to things. And I think basically debates haven't done that. I tried to do that in the debates I moderated, and I think I got part of the way. I don't think that I would be allowed to do it if anybody, which they never have, and never will, asked me to moderate a presidential debate. They would think I was weird, because our campaigns are so disconnected from the office that they serve. So now that's my general thought. And then specifically, how do you have a debate where one of the candidates believes something that is verifiably untrue, which means he's either delusional or he is building his campaign around a lie that's one of the most sensitive things in a democracy? You can't have a forum and format in which an exchange of ideas is supposed to take place in which one of the people does not engage with ideas in the way that forum requires. It's like, I don't know how you fix that.
Yeah. I feel sad about this. Like, there are questions I would really like to know the answers to. Is Donald Trump going to call for enforcing the Comstock Act? Is Donald Trump going to tell the FDA to reverse its approval of the abortion pill mifepristone, etc.? Like, there are pressing policy questions that he has not answered. But there is no way that if he gets asked those things on a debate stage that he is going to give any kind of clear answer. None. And then there's going to be all of this smoke about the election being stolen, that huge lie, and many other lies that just roll off his tongue. And I think you're right that a debate demands a kind of basic set of shared facts, right? And degree of candor and just like subscribing to reality on both sides. And Donald Trump doesn't live in that world. And so then it creates this kind of visibly equal platform between these two people in which one person is still treated with respect, even as they're just like crapping all over the reality-based set of assumptions that are supposed to underpin the whole thing. And I don't think in the moment there is an answer for that.
There's definitely not an answer as a debate moderator, because you have to like stop the debate and go, for a moment, let me just reorient us back towards the fact that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and that the sky's up. And the, I mean, you have to like resort the orientation of the basic geographical principles of life. And I think also it's a problem, just from a kind of tactical standpoint, in that the entire Republican Party has decided to sign on to somebody who not only believes this verifiably untrue thing that would disenfranchise 81 million people, but also has supported each of its component parts, which includes not only treating free and fair elections as disposable, but also undermining the rule of law, basically saying any of these legal cases Trump is engaged in are politically motivated. And then finally, being perfectly fine with easily verifiable mistruths said repeatedly for the purposes of winning an election. I mean, these aren't just the behaviors of a single candidate. They have now been endorsed, and they are so known to mankind that you can't endorse them and step away from them. At this point, the endorsement of Donald Trump, Trump is a promise or is an expectation that he will engage in these behaviors as president again.
Can we get to the sort of practical question of, if you are Biden, should you want to debate Trump? If you are Trump, should you want to debate Biden? Biden is behind, apparently. Trump is a weird maniac during debates. Biden's a pretty good debater. He's not a terrible debater. So maybe he should want it. Trump seems to want to debate Biden, but yet maybe it's just because it gives him the imprimatur, the respect. It elevates him. But he did duck all the Republican debates because he perceived that that could hurt him. So I don't know why he wouldn't want to duck this debate. So whose tactical interest is it to have a debate?
Well, now Trump is saying anywhere, anytime. He's decided it's in his tactical interest to be baiting Biden and to force Biden to be the one to say no. And I think that's a smart tactic, as usual. Like, I think Trump is great at these kind of tactical moves. And he's putting Biden in a tricky position. And this letter from all the TV networks, of course, is supporting Trump's call and pressure on Biden to say yes, because it makes it seem like the reasonable kind of pro-democracy, respectable thing to do.
I think Emily is 100% right. I would add a couple of other things. First of all, Donald Trump's excesses are well known. So there's almost nothing he could do on stage that would increase the people's view of his excesses. They might reintroduce some people to him. I do buy the argument that a lot of the polling that we see is informed by people who are paying attention to other things in their lives and not really remembering or thinking through a full Trump presidency. But I don't think a debate is going to do anything different than the just regular course of things would do to inform that group of people. So in other words, he can act however he wants to act, and it isn't going to hurt him. On the upside, he's got the following things. One, the frame of a debate as an equal contest between the two parties in which they both believe in the idea of verifiable information. That frame exists, and all the coverage will just the way we've seen the coverage of this campaign go forward like it's a normal campaign, will treat them that way. And so Trump will be treated like any old candidate. And that will help him with the voters he needs to help. he needs help with? Who are the voters who need to say, well, you know, he's not that bad. Yeah, he says some mean tweets. We're well beyond mean tweets. But a debate moves us back to the category of mean tweets. Presidents aren't very good in their first debates. Biden's got a busy plate, like all presidents do, but particularly between China, Russia, Ukraine, Israel. It's a busy job being president. And so when you are the candidate who has A, to not look old on stage, which is tough, and B, can't engage in the antics that Donald Trump is, has to be a counterweight to him. To be a counterweight to the antics, you have to, you know, really, really be on your game because you're judged by a different set of metrics, which are harder. So, and Donald Trump should say, I want to debate anywhere, anytime, if he thinks Biden will say no, because then it makes it look like Trump is the one who's got nothing to fear and Biden does.
I was thinking about, like, if you look back in the last couple of elections, in 2016, I think ultimately Trump, you know, Trump was a looming, alarming, sexist presence in the presidential debates with Hillary Clinton. But he seemed different, right? It was a change election. He clearly showed he would be a change. In 2020, I think people were sick of the chaos, and Biden's calmness and his kind of like his like, come on, man, come off it, man, line against Trump. It was a very effective. It was like people wanted that sort of reasonableness and calm demeanor. I feel like 2024 is much more like 2016 than it is like 2020. It's like people are annoyed. They're not in the mood for sort of a calm, doddering, reasonable old dude. They're angry, and Trump's chaos and manic and unpleasant energy will not harm him in the way I think it did in 2020. Let us go to cocktail chatters. A lot of Vermont beer up here in Vermont. There's a Vermont bourbon, which is around, which I haven't yet tried because I hate bourbon, but maybe it's good. Emily, what are you going to be chattering about with your New Haven bourbon?
My New Haven bourbon. I love it. I am going up to Dartmouth next week, the night of Thursday, April 18th, to do a conversation with one of my favorite podcasters, Erica Heilman, who does the Rumblefish podcast about Vermont, which I feel like I must have plugged on the show because I'm such a big fan of it. And I'm just totally looking forward to this. So you should come if you can. It's at the Dartmouth Humanities School with the Center for Cartoon Studies. We can post a link. It's a conversation from 5 to 6:30 p.m. And since we're talking about Erica and Rumblefish, she's done a recent series lately where she's just been asking different people in Vermont what class they're in and how they think about class. And it's just a really rich series of conversations that I recommend, separately from whether you can make it to the show or not.
Speaking of the Center for Cartoon Studies, one of the things I've read this week is the Watership Down that James Sturm, the head of the Center for Cartoon Studies, created, which I'm sure we've definitely hyped on.
I did a GabFest Reads about that.
Yeah, it was so good. It was so lovely. I loved it. I loved it. Congratulations, James Sturm, and everyone else who was part of that. John, what is your chatter?
Well, we've gotten the log rolling out of the way with the plugging of navel gazing, but my actual chatter, though, is a piece by Rachel Wolf in the Wall Street Journal. And the headline of the piece is "The Calls Are Coming from Above the Poverty Line." And it is a great piece about people who call 211. Everybody knows what 911 is for. People may not know what 211 is for. 211 is a hotline for people who are experiencing, you know, economic stress, although they call for all kinds of different reasons. And it's run by the United Way. And the United Way has set up 200 or so of these call centers. And so Rachel hung out at the call center and listened to people who are, and this is the important part of the piece, who are living above the poverty line. So they are not a number of subsidies and government programs that would be available to you if you live below the poverty line are not available to you. And this is for the United Way has a term. It calls this population ALICE, asset limited, income constrained, employed, which is to say the working poor. It figures there are about 36 million American households who are in that category. And those are the people who basically, it's basically quadruple the poverty line for a family of four, who are the working poor, who are nevertheless struggling with all of the challenges that that what you might think of as traditional poverty would encompass. And so on these phone calls, they try to help people. But the big challenge and the thrust of the piece again is that basically the poverty line is misaligned, and that benefits and help doesn't come to this group of 36 million Americans.
My chatter was about a genuinely philosophically difficult, provocative short article in the New York Times this week, which is, should you brush your teeth right when you get up or after breakfast? It is literally one of the most difficult questions on earth. Like, what is the right answer?
I can't believe I missed this. I'm obsessed with this question. What's the right answer?
What do you think the right answer is? I'm interested in your guys'.
I kind of think the answer is both. That's been my latest solution to this problem.
Isn't that hell on the enamel?
I don't know. David, what's the right answer?
John, do you have an answer?
I guess my answer is, I don't know. I think my answer is when you wake up, man. You gotta reset the day.
So the answer is,
you definitely have to do it when you wake up, but then don't you also, anyway, sometimes I have like a piece of Trident gum after breakfast instead of brushing my teeth twice. Okay. Sorry, David.
So the answer is there is no answer. They don't know. The answer is like, it is very unclear what the answer is. There are arguments for both. Well, I'm like you, Emily. I brush my teeth before and after, no doubt. Like always
a
double
brush. You also brush your teeth at lunch a lot. Which was a revelation to me when I worked with you. I was like, oh my God, I never thought of that. It's great. Except I do wonder how many times you can brush your teeth in the day.
Yeah, you are a brushist.
I brush my teeth a lot during the day, and my mouth feels minty fresh a lot of the time, and it's great. So the arguments for doing it right when you get up is you're getting rid of killing the bacteria immediately. It just feels nicer. And you also remember to do it. One of the things they point out is that if you say, I'm going to put it off till after breakfast, there's a certain category of people who, if they put it off till after breakfast, don't remember to do it because they're like, they got to get the kids to school. And then they realize, oh shoot, I've forgotten to do it. So it's easier to habituate it if you do it first. If you do it after breakfast, you can sweep away the carbs of breakfast and you're kind of have this whole longer period where your mouth feels fresher and the active ingredients in your toothpaste and your saliva are working on your clean mouth for a longer period. And so their view is kind of whatever works for you habitually, you should stick with. And because there doesn't appear to be a right answer, but it was a very provocative article, and it's been the subject of most of the conversation I've had this week.
So the habit is more important than when you deploy the habit.
Yes, for the moment until we get better answers. Listeners, there is no possible way you have a better chatter than my chatter this week. Is there? Is there? I suspect there is. Listeners have emailed us great chatters. Thanks for answering the call. Please keep it up. We need more great listener chatters. Email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. Something that you are talking about at your cocktail parties. And our listener chatter this week comes from Mark Phillips from Baltimore.
Hello, this is Mark Phillips from Baltimore, a listener from the very dawn of the GabFest. My chatter tag teams onto David Plotz's mention last week of crows outside his home office window. Last month, The New Yorker featured an article by Ben Crair titled The Magic of Bird Brains, which reveals some interesting facts about crows and their behavior. As the article makes clear, if David takes an active interest in his crows, he can enjoy the opportunity for the crows to train him to do their bidding. But there is a warning. If David insults or abuses the crow, they will never forgive him and will loudly curse him out whenever he leaves his home. Not only that, all the other crows in the area will know David Plotz to be unrighteous among the crows and will pass that designation down from generation to generation.
That's our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Shayna Roth, back in the saddle. We missed you, Shayna. Our researcher is Julie Hugen. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond, Senior Director for Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of Audio. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. And if you listen to our Slate Plus segment, you will realize that we will talk to you in perpetuity. Bye-bye. Hello, Hello, Slate Plus. So this was a Slate Plus idea that from John Dickerson, which I initially had absolutely no enthusiasm about. I thought it was a terrible idea. And then I started to think about it and realized, oh, man, do I have thoughts on this? So, John, thanks for making me think twice. You sent around a tweet, maybe, or maybe it was a thread about Laurie Anderson is now communicating via chatbot with her dead old partner, friend, muse, Lou Reed. And it was just that. I don't know if there was a further article. I read a whole article
about it. She's like kind of obsessed with doing it, and her friends are like kind of worried for her that she's doing it so much.
And then when I mentioned this, my daughter then sent me also, there was a Modern Love about a woman who's a young widow who has spent some time using an AI to recreate a conversation with her husband who died young. So she had one more conversation with her husband who had died in an accident. And so she used AI to recreate that. So John, talk about what interested you and sort of why this has become possible, and then what interested you in this about this.
Yeah. Well, I just went through the process of my father-in-law's funeral, Leonard McKeon, who was just the most wonderful person. Anne gave an amazing eulogy, and I also spoke at his funeral. And, you know, that puts you in touch with the difficult, but also I'm grateful for it, process of having to think seriously about, you know, summing up a person's life and their essential qualities and all of that. And so that's the mindset I bring to this. I think that being in touch with those essential qualities, which have been so much a part of your life, assuming it's replicable, which I think some parts of it can be, because not only is AI getting better, but part of what we do with relationships is fill in the blanks. You know, so you would, let's imagine that AI creates a kind of Swiss cheese version of your loved one. I think you fill in the holes, and the active act of filling in the holes is a part of living. And so I think this could be incredibly therapeutic, not necessarily restrictive, you know, in other words, keeping you in a bubble. But I think that could be a danger, and I don't know how you would guard against that. I mean, you could imagine just staying inside all day long, because the external world reminds you of all the things you can't do with your partner. So I don't downplay the negative part of this. And I also, by the way, and this is an admission that will make people like totally, well, I guess they already know me. I've had long conversations with ChatGPT, the one that has, you know, has created voice and can, so it's both a digital voice, which sounds quite lifelike, and can read your voice. But if you're ever reading like a complicated poem and engage ChatGPT in questions about the poem, and then kind of have just follow your curiosity.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.